Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And happy Martin Luther King Day to you. Welcome, my friends. Now, it's 6 minutes after the hour here on the Tom Hartman radio program. Joe Madison is with us. JoeMadison.com is website. Joe is a progressive talk show host. The Black Eagle Radio Show is actually the name of his program. And, Joe, welcome to the program.
My hero, Tom Hartman. How are you?
Well, you're very kind, Joe. Thank you.
Oh, you're kind to have me, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be on.
You're doing great work. By the way, looking at your website, I can get into inside your website, but just as a heads up, maybe we have the same internet service provider. I don't know what the deal is, but your main page, if somebody just types in joemadison.com, they get a blank document.
It's really?
A completely blank page. Yeah, now here's the...
I got to tell you, I'm going to check with the guy who does that. I am absolutely... deficient when it comes to that. I've got an excellent webmaster. He might be working on some things because we've been adding and updating because of the new year.
Okay.
But
people...
I will definitely do it, or else people can go to blackeagle.com, I think.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah, you might want to try that one.
We'll check
that out.
I bet
he's working on some new stuff.
But joemadison.com should be the website. TomHartman.com, by the way, should be our website. We've had Earthlink hosting our website for years, and this morning it was down, and so the folks who want to get into our chat room, normally we run a chat room during our program, it's nothing's coming up. So I called Earthlink, and they routed me to their technical support person in the Philippines, who said that they would try to get it back up again. So as soon as we hear from the Philippines, we will know.
Well, I know my webmaster's down the street.
Well,
I hope.
See, yeah, that's a whole lot better. I'm telling you, I don't want to get into it.
I know that's a whole other topic.
Yeah, there you go. Let's talk about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. We're speaking with Joe Madison, the host of the Black Eagle Radio Show. What do you think is the most significant and enduring legacy of Martin Luther King?
Oh, I think the enduring legacy was the end of segregation. There's no ifs, ands, buts about it. It had impacted well over 50% of the lives of African Americans, particularly those that lived in the South, but not exclusively. And most important of all, it impacted the lives of the white people who tried to perpetuate it and maintain it legally, or as the Supreme Court justices said in Brown versus Board of Education, either de jure or de facto. There's no ifs, ands, buts about it. That was his enduring legacy. And then, of course, just before his assassination, he was moving into the second phase, which was militarism and poverty, because he always talked about the triple evils: racism, militarism, and poverty. I'm certain that's where he was headed.
Now, when Dr. Martin Luther King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech, it was the last speech of the day. He was preceded by other luminaries like John Lewis. There was some kind of jockeying for leadership of the movement, shall we say, going on at the time.
Wow, you know your history. You really do. Matter of fact, I will tell you, one of the things when your website gets back up, but for people who can, you should go on the internet and get John Lewis's original text that was actually changed at the back of the Lincoln Memorial because it was considered too militant. I did this research because I had the pleasure of presenting an award here in Washington to Congressman John Lewis, who I've known for, so many years now. I found the original text that was written. There was a big argument among the more saged, older speakers and organizers who didn't want him to give this militant speech as a representative of SNCC. He did decide to change it. It was still a dynamic speech. And, you know, of course, this jockeying of prominence is nothing new. I have bruises. I told the audience today I've got bruises where I've been elbowed and pushed, who gets in the center frame, who gets sure. next to who.
Welcome to the human race.
Yeah, I mean, you know what, that just happens. It's just human nature. But I'd much rather have people jockeying for positions of leadership than trying to ignore it or not take on leadership.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think a lot of people didn't realize that, in fact, the most people at the time, the organizers of the event, figured that by the time Dr. Martin Luther King got up to speak, that most of the news cameras would be gone because they'd be off processing their film by that time.
You know, I don't know. Yeah, in those days, it's not like today. You're absolutely right. But I think they arranged so that it would be carried live, or at least it would be taped. And as you know, the White House was listening very carefully.
Well, and this is what catapulted him to fame.
This was the speech of his life. The thing that's really interesting is, and I was reading an article yesterday in the Washington Post, do you know most school children have not heard the complete speech?
Well, the complete speech is subversive, or at least was by the standards of that day. I mean, that's a very, very strong speech.
Yeah, they get the climax, which was not actually in the original text of the speech. And the reason a lot of school children aren't hearing it is because the speech was copywritten by the family. And many of the schools simply can't afford multiple copies. Mm-hmm. of the original speech. And I think one of the disservices we do to Dr. King is we only hear the climax, the I Have a Dream part.
Yeah.
You have to hear the entire speech to understand what he really charged those 200,000 and people across the country to do on that August afternoon.
Yeah, and in fact, we're going to have a member of his family on in the next hour, and one of the questions that I'd like to ask is, you know, why not just put that thing out there in the public domain?
But I talked about that. I don't know who you're going to have on, but I know Martin and Dexter very, very well.
It's going to be Alveda King Tooks.
Oh, okay. I'm not familiar with her. But, you know, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, he left very little money to his family. Very little money.
Well, he lived a life of poverty. And he lived what he taught.
He lived what he taught.
He was like Gandhi.
Absolutely,
you know?
Right. And he asked that Harry Belafonte help, you know, make sure his family would be taken care of. And one of the things they did was that they did copyright his speeches. Now, on one hand, I got to tell you, I don't think that should be an excuse that poor schools can't afford it, because it's just a question of budget priority.
Sure.
And I certainly know that young people can buy $18, $20 CDs and, you know, DVDs for all kinds of people, like 50 cents and others.
Right.
They can afford that. And so the family, this is really how they make
it. That's how they've survived. Yeah,
that's how they've survived down through the years. And then you got to be very careful, because everybody and their grandmother would use his image and his words and his speeches for commercial purposes.
Yeah, absolutely. And the last thing you want is an ad for iPods with, exploiting MLK's image, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King's image.
Okay, Sean, today I read in the paper, in a city paper here in Washington, it's a free paper, there was actually an ad for an X-rated video store, Martin Luther King Day sale.
Oh, geez.
I mean,
there's got to be limits.
This is, and unless we really study and understand the courage of his commitment and what he really meant, and use this day appropriately, it's only going to get worse.
We're talking with Joe Madison. JoeMadison.com is his website. The Black Eagle Radio Show, BlackEagle.com also, if JoeMadison.com doesn't get you there. And The enduring legacy of nonviolence seems to be, in my mind, at least at an edge. We've got a little less than a minute here, Joe. What can we do to bring back his Gandhian vision?
I think that every person in position of power, in position of who have resources, who have ears, and who has a voice. I don't care if it's Hillary Clinton, Obama. I think that we have to end the violence that's taking place in Iraq, which is about ready to take place in Iran. One of the great speeches King gave was about the fact that the next war could wipe out all of humanity.
Right, and the need to end war.
That's the nonviolence that we should really be concerned about.
There you go. Joe Madison, brilliantly said. JoeMadison.com is website. He's the host of the Black Eagle Radio Show. Joe, thanks so much. An honor to have you on the program.
Anytime.
Great talking with you, my friend. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
A true revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say a war. This way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, filling our nation's homes and with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields, physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, and not be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love.
Well said. It's Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Welcome back to our program. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here, where reason is our lifestyle choice. Iran, this from The Guardian, stepped up its defiance of international pressure over its nuclear program yesterday by warning of soaring oil prices if subjected to economic sanctions. There's talk about the UN Security Council imposing Iraq-like sanctions on Iran, and Iran is the world's fourth largest oil producer, and they're saying, you do that, you're going to see $100 a barrel oil. In fact, last week, Mr. Mohatir Takin of the Center for Global Energy Studies argued that crude prices could easily hit $100 a barrel if Iran stopped exporting. He says supply and demand at this moment are very tightly balanced. In a provocative move, Iran also announced plans yesterday to convene a so-called scientific conference to examine the evidence supporting the Holocaust. This is over the top. It's like they're poking us as hard as we're poking them. I'm amazed by this. Two American senators said the U.S. might undertake a strike of last resort to prevent Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons. That would be John McCain and Evan Bayh. Evan Bayh, the DLC Democrat, who I believe he's the head of the DLC. I could be wrong on that, but he's certainly one of the more prominent of the DLC Democrats. Urging diplomacy, but saying that if it doesn't work, you know, we'll take them out. We'll take them out. So we'll see how that shakes out. For the folks trying to get into our chat room, my apologies. Our website is down today. It doesn't appear that we've been hacked. It's just a plain old server crash, apparently, according to Earthlink's tech support in the Philippines. And as soon as they get it back up, we will get it back up for you. So TomHartman.com should be coming along here one of these days soon. China, capitalism doesn't require democracy. We're going to get to this in just a moment. First, Dave in Montgomery, Alabama, wanted to comment about Joe Madison. Hey, Dave. By the way, our phone number, 1-866-440-8466, all across the United States. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey, what's going on, guys?
I'm here. What's up?
Okay. Nothing. Really, I just turned on your show a little while ago, and I heard Joe talking, and I just wanted to call in and tell him that I think he's a great American. I think he's a very well-spoken gentleman. I saw him speak on C-SPAN one time. I believe it was about the Downing Street memos and whatnot. They had a lot of the liberal media in there, Al Franken and the bunch. And I heard Joe speak with no notes, He spoke for quite a long time, and he's just the most eloquent person I've ever seen speak without any notes at all. And I just wanted to call and compliment him, and I think he's a great American and a leader for us all.
Well, hopefully he's still listening, and we'll be sure and pass that along to him, Dave. Thanks a lot for the
great guest, Tom. Great show, bud.
Yeah, Joe's a good guy. Thanks a lot, Dave. Good to hear from you. And thanks for listening to the program. 1-866-440-8466. Before we've got callers on the line here. If you're on the line, hang on. We will get to the phone calls here today. But I do want to get into this issue a little bit here. Robert Reich published a piece on Common Dreams recently that really lays this thing out. And this is the point that I was making in the debate that I had last week with Andrew Bernstein from the Ayn Rand Institute. And he's saying, Microsoft shouldn't be going along with China in censoring words like democracy from the Internet. And they are. And not just. On things. And my point is, and I've been saying this for 3 years on this program, capitalism is not democracy. Free enterprise is not democracy. Democracy is a form of governance in which we the people could collectively make the rules and decisions in which we live. And we live in a constitutionally limited democratic republic. And, that has nothing to do with capitalism. Capitalism is our economic system. And I'm not an anti-capitalist. I've started businesses. I've owned businesses. I'm not criticizing capitalism, but there are so many people who think that it's the same thing. And in fact, one of the main parts of the conservative agenda right now is to cause people to think that capitalism and free enterprise are the same thing as democracy. And they are very, very separate. In fact, I would say that Franklin Roosevelt, by putting limits on what the robber barons could do, and for that matter, Senator Sherman of Ohio back in 1880 with the Sherman Antitrust Act, putting limits, appropriate limits, on what capitalists can do so that the big don't get so big that there's no opportunity for the small to get into the marketplace, saved capitalism from itself. Robert Reich pointing out there are more building cranes in use today in China than in all of the United States. The gap between China's rich and poor is turning into a chasm. And we're seeing in China now a robber baron era. And capitalism is flourishing. And yet it's doing it in the midst of an absolute dictatorship. 29 minutes past the hour. 27 minutes.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
From writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again, and don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming, for the loser now will be later to win, for the times, they are a-changing.
And boy, are they changing. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Are we seeing the beginning of totalitarianism, dictatorship, instead of democracy in the United States? George W. Bush and his bunch, the whole conservative pitch, for years and years and years, I mean, this goes back all the way back to the Cold War. Their pitch has been that there is I don't want to say similarity, that democracy depends upon capitalism, that capitalism depends upon democracy, and yet what we are seeing right now in China is the rise of capitalism in the presence of a dictatorship. In China, if you speak out against the government, you are put in prison. Period. You could be put to death if you speak out against the government. If a corporation wants to do business in China, you have Rupert Murdoch, who runs Fox News, censoring his TV satellite there. I believe it's called Star TV. I don't recall right off the top of my head, but it's something like that. offering censorship to the Chinese government? Microsoft helping censor, you know, on behalf of the Chinese government, their products? Facilitating totalitarian as well, it's good for business. I mean, this is, it shouldn't take China to wake people up to this. I mean, you know, it's not like there's not a long string of right-wing totalitarian governments. I mean, without going to extreme examples like Hitler or Mussolini or Franco or Pinochet, that were strongly aligned with business. And that's not to say that business leads to totalitarianism, and it's not to say that totalitarianism requires capitalism, for that matter. I mean, look at the Soviet Union with no capitalism. It was another totalitarian state. The point is that economic systems like communism, capitalism, whatever you want to call it, are completely separate from and independent of political systems like communism, the political system of communism, or a democratic republic like that in which we live. They're completely separate things. And yet, over and over and over again, conservatives will try to convince you, no, they're not separate things. They're the same thing. If you want to have freedom, you got to have the freedom to die old and hungry. Right? In other words, no social security. Or you got to have the freedom to choose from 27 different Medicare programs. You can't figure out any of them, and somebody's making a buck on all of them. And Robert Reich points this out, you know, absolutely brilliantly in this piece that he published on Common Dreams last week. Capitalism does not need democracy. He says, as China shows, capitalism doesn't necessarily provide enough protection for individuals to take risks with their opinions. Well said. At the same time, we find that tax cuts have nothing to do with job creation. This is a study that was just published by United for a Fair Economy. George Bush, last Friday in Chicago, said, by cutting taxes on income, we help create jobs. Well, while 2 million jobs were created in 2005, that's 3.5 million jobs short of what the President's Council of Economic Advisers suggested. Jobs grew at a rate of 1.5% in 2005, and it's got nothing to do with tax cuts. In fact, as Anisha Desai, the program director of UFE and one of the report's co-authors, that's United for a Fair Economy, said, the president's tax-cutting policy is a failure in regard to job creation, and we need to recognize it as such. While there is no evidence that massive tax cuts create jobs, there is considerable evidence that they contribute to economy-choking deficits, which, by the way, are going to destroy jobs. What they found in this study, tax cuts have no predictable effect on employment, either in job creation or job destruction. Since 2003, job creation has fallen millions of jobs short of the administration's promises, and the current weakness in job creation during an economic recovery is unprecedented since World War II. No recovery has been as badly, has happened as poorly and as badly as the Bush recovery. Why? Because they're pursuing conservative economic programs. These crazed conservative economic programs that make no sense at all. And it's just very, 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 very straightforward. So anyhow, we've got a jolly good fellow for the day. The state of Maryland, this was vetoed by Republican Governor Bob Ehrlich, and the legislature overrode his veto. This is a new law that directs firms with more than 10,000 employees to spend at least 8% of their payrolls on employee health benefits. It's called a fair share law. 30 other states are looking at them. And this is a law, congratulations to the legislators of the great state of Maryland. This is a law, basically, that would force Walmart to do something. Walmart is one of a number of employers in Maryland. There are four altogether who employ more than 10,000 people. Only four companies in Maryland. Of those four, three of them spend at least 8% of their payroll on health care. Walmart does not. They employ 17,000 people in the state. So basically, this is a Walmart law. And what we see is that the percentage of businesses that offer health insurance has declined for five straight years. The cost of health insurance premium has gone up 73% during that same period of time. George W. Bush crazed economic policies, while Bill Frist and his family in the healthcare business are becoming billionaires. And then, you know, the pharmaceutical industry, you know, getting in on this. By the way, if you're a veteran, I was just talking with Larry Scott of VAWatchdog.org, And he said, if you're a veteran, don't sign up for any of the Medicare programs. Get your pharmaceuticals through the VA because they actually negotiate with the government and get good prices. But this from Snopes.com, checking on an email that's floating around the place. The price of generic drugs can vary widely from one pharmacy to another. This guy talks about buying 100 pills of a particular pharmaceutical at one place. This is a pharmaceutical, a generic pharmaceutical. At one place, it was $54.99. At Costco, it was $19.89. There's huge variability of price, even on generics. And in addition to that, consider the markups, some of these guys. And this is from the Snopes.com website. And they point out this is inflammatory because, you know, the cost of a drug isn't just the cost of the manufacturing. You've got also the cost of research and development. Sure, I acknowledge that. But you've also got the cost of marketing and of paying off the guys who are paying off the doctors. But still, nonetheless, you consider Celebrex, for example, 100 tabs, $130. What's the cost of the active ingredients? 60 cents. What's the percent of markup for that company? 21,712%. 10 milligram Claritin, 100 tablets, $215 retail. Cost of active ingredients for all 100 tablets? 71 cents. Percent of markup? 30,306%. Lipitor, 20 milligram, 100 tablets. Cost you pay? $272.37. The cost of the active ingredients, $5.80, 4,696% markup. And it goes on and on and on. It's just some of these are just absolutely mind-boggling. Xanax, 1 milligram, you pay $136.79. What's the cost to manufacture? 2.5 cents. Markup, 569,000%. Percent! Now, as I said, we have to acknowledge that cost of that, if you look at the cost of Coke, it's probably just a few pennies, and you end up, paying a buck for a Coke or for the cost of coffee or whatever. There's a lot of other costs that go into things. But still, the Veterans Administration is somehow able to dispense pharmaceuticals for a fraction of the price that people on Medicare are having to pay. And on top of that, they're having to pay private for-profit corporations to get insurance, to get their Medicare, to get their pharmaceuticals. Why is that? Because the Veterans Administration is socialized medicine, and they negotiate with the government. Whereas Medicare has, in fact, a rule in it that says that you can't, the government cannot negotiate with the Veterans Administration negotiates with the pharmaceutical companies. And the Medicare law says that the government is forbidden from negotiating with the pharmaceutical companies. So a drug that costs them a tenth of a penny a pill to make, and they're selling for, $5 a piece, the government can't say, hey, instead of $5, how about you sell it to us for 20 cents? Because we're going to buy 5 million of them. After all, you're going to make some money here. Can't do it. And so, a lot of folks making a lot of money. And good old Billy Tawson, one of the guys who was the author of this thing, now making over $1 million a year as a lobbyist for the pharmaceutical industry. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. John in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, John, we've got to take a break in just about a minute. But a quick comment you had?
Yeah. I'm a businessman and one of your bigger fans. I listen to you all the time.
Thank you, John.
If I had 5 to 10% of my business my outlays every year in debt that was financed by a bank or by another entity, I would pretty much have a real cozy relationship with that bank or entity because they hold my debt. If they call my debt in, then I'm in trouble.
Right.
The Chinese and the Saudi Arabians own a large part of our workable debt.
Sure, they may be buying between the two of them as much as at least a third and as much as a half on any given year now that Bush is...
They got us by what we call the short hair.
There you go. There you go. And there's very little we can do about it other than stopping the insane and irrational trade policies and economic policies that are driving us so badly into debt that we're having to borrow all that money. Bush is borrowing $2 billion a day. John, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate you listening to us there in Louisville, and thank you for calling. $2 billion a day that he's borrowing to keep this country going. And you look around and you say, well, things don't look so bad. Well, hey, loan me $2 billion a day, and I'll make things look pretty good, too. Somebody's going to have to pay the bill someday, though. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
There is a war between the rich and poor, a war between the man and the woman. There is a war between the ones who say there is a war and the ones who say there is a war.
Indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Small Dog Electronics bringing you the program today. 1-800-511-MAX. 1-800-511-MACS. SmallDog.com, the website. Get the latest iPods and all things Macintosh, all things electronic. Welcome back to the program, the Tom Hartman Program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. In today's Wall Street Journal, currency reserves held by Beijing continue to swell. China's foreign exchange reserves ballooned to 818.9 billion at the end of the last year. They go on to note, by the way, if China, I'm quoting from Andrew Brown in the Wall Street Journal, if China were to start selling the dollars in its reserves, it could weaken the U.S. currency and force the U.S. to raise rates to continue to attract sufficient capital inflows to cover its huge current account deficit. I'm telling you, we're looking at an economic train wreck here. We'll get into a little more detail on it as the day goes on. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Josh in Long Island, New York, on the line. Hey, Josh, welcome to the program.
Hey, I have a distinct recollection of Randy Rhodes saying, I think it was last summer, that 25% of our troops died from not having enough armor, according to the Department of Defense. And on top of that, I learned from your guest host on Friday, maybe it was Ed Schultz talking to Chris Dodd, that they had a bill 3 years ago that the law should mandate to have enough troops, and the Republicans actually shot it down,
yeah.
Even though I already had enough information to know the troops were getting screwed. My point is, how is it possible that even someone like myself, let alone Sean Hannity and his listeners, are not made aware of this information?
Well, you've had Howard Dean yelling about this. I mean, it's not like Democrats aren't out there yelling about this. So there was a report issued last week that indicated that, and I don't have the report in front of me, so I don't remember the exact percentage,
80%.
But some very significant percent, yeah, 80% is what stuck in my mind. But of the torso injuries that killed our troops over the last 3 years could have been prevented had they had state-of-the-art body armor, which is available, and the Bush administration has been reluctant to buy. Because, they've got to save some money here and there, right, so that they can have more tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. And Democrats are screaming about this, and it's simply not being covered by the mainstream
media. Well, I saw CNN, Lou Dobbs directly covered that report last week. And,
Lou Dobbs is the only guy out there.
Well,
and Lou Dobbs amazes me, because here's a guy who's a Republican. He's a lifelong Republican. I mean, he's right up front about it. He's a Republican. And he's talking about some of the, Keith Olbermann are the only two guys who are really talking about real issues.
At the end of the report, Lou Dobbs said to his correspondent, so CNN can definitively say that our troops have had sufficient body armor. The guy was like, well, yeah, according to the Marines. And that was the end of the story. But again, we don't even have to go into the report from last week because, like I said, you got Chris Dodd's bill that was shot down by Republicans in the DOD's report themselves. So, not to mention the troops having to go buy their own body armor.
Yeah.
And you do mention the Military Times.
Oh, I know. If this stuff had happened under the Clinton administration, they would have him out on the White House lawn, drawn, quartered, and being eaten alive by red ants right now. I mean,
yeah,
the right wing bloviating machine would have been so on it that they would have Bill Clinton impaled on the spikes on the top of around the White House lawn. I'm telling you,
it's a battle. We need to get people like Dodd and Dean and Kerry and everybody else focusing on that and doing a much better job than the government.
They are. They have been doing a marvelous job on it. The problem is they talk about this stuff and it never makes the evening news.
You know,
that's the thing. What you have is a White House press corps that is absolutely cowed. We have now gone from news to infotainment, and because it's now an entertainment industry, and the profitability of a news program is the main thing that the owners, by the way, like NBC, giant defense contractors, the profitability of the news program is the only thing they're looking at. And so they, you know, if covering a missing white girl in Aruba is going to make more profit than talking about body armor, then they're all for it. And for that matter, if talking about body armor in a way that reflects poorly on the Bush administration is going to cause the Bush administration to stop asking their correspondent questions in press conferences, they're not willing to take that risk because they know that by taking that risk, what they're going to do is they're going to reduce their own ratings. And it's all about ratings. It's all about money. It's not about the news anymore. And you can thank Ronald Reagan for that, because in 1987 he dropped that provision of the fairness doctrine that required radio and television stations to carry real news and to perform community service in order to keep their licenses, which was all about real news. Josh, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good point that you make, and well said. Bill in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I listen to Dark Side Radio periodically, and I was able to talk with Paul Bremer on the program that claims they're the cultural pioneer or something like that. Anyway, Michael Medved show. Mm. Anyway, he said, I asked him about the $8.6 billion I described about the...
that vanished on his watch, yeah.
Yeah, right. Anyway, he said that it was false and that it was used for... it was sent over there to be used for administrative costs, and that the money wasn't stolen. And this was after you had said last week that it was, and so I just had to call you up and ask you about it.
Well, to the best of my knowledge, according to the investigative arm of Congress, that money is unaccounted for. Now, uh-huh. Maybe...
Wow, I wish I'd known that, because I could have asked him about it.
Yeah, I mean, this is not a secret, by the way, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a secret.
Well, I didn't think it was.
It should be
easily
Googled.
Several other sources.
I mean, we're talking a pile of money that could be seen from outer space.
Yeah.
Bill,
okay.
Thanks a lot for the call.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Sometimes these guys, they are so brazen. They just figure they can just bluff their way through anything. And do. That's the thing that's so amazing about it. So, anyhow, I want to continue with this economic situation here. We're also going to talk to Dr. Alveda King Tooks. Niece of Dr. Martin Luther King. Today is Martin Luther King Day. And in our third hour, we're going to be have some folks on about the best of the rest of the news. Should be an interesting conversation. So stick around. 57 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
So China's reserves, currency reserves held by Beijing, continue to swell. I'm telling you, this you start putting two and two and two and two together, and you start getting 2, 4, 6, 8, and you start going, whoa, what's going on? Coupled with other evidence of breakneck economic growth in China, the buildup of reserves is definitely helping Western countries to add pressure on China for currency appreciation. That seems like good news, right? This is from the article from the Wall Street Journal today. But the bad news? We're having to borrow $2 billion a day to keep our economy looking good. George W. Bush has run us an absolute train wreck. He has run us so far into debt in order to try and make the American economy look like it's halfway decent. And who's going to pay for this? Our children and grandchildren. And us! Ronald Reagan did the exact same thing. Massive tax cuts in his first year in office. Of course, he then raised taxes 6 consecutive years. Cons won't tell you about that. Because it was so incredibly destructive. It didn't produce the increased revenues. But George W. Bush apparently doesn't have the common sense of Ronald Reagan to raise taxes back to some rational level. But in any case, this year we're paying $160 billion just on the interest on the debt that Ronald Reagan ran up. As for the New York Times, the White House acknowledged on Thursday that the budget deficit would climb above $400 billion this year for 2006. That's up from $319 billion in 2005. And by the way, it's really not $319 billion because we borrowed about $200 billion from Social Security. So it was really about $519 billion. deficit forecast, $60 billion, larger than what the administration predicted in July. Why? Because Bush has never seen a bill that he won't sign. He spends like crazy, and he has all these crazy tax cuts that are reducing the taxes for millionaires and billionaires and gazillionaires. Not you and me, thank you very much. We got $300 back, what, 3 years ago? But it's helping out the wealthy, shall we say. Well, as the New York Times points out, I mean, just a straight-up reporting here by Edmund Andrews. Since President Bush took office in 2001, the federal budget has swung from a surplus of more than $100 billion to deficits as high as $412 billion in 2004. Last year, the deficit narrowed unexpectedly to $319 billion, mainly because of a surge in corporate tax revenues and taxes on stock market gains. And that, of course, because people were taking capital gains returns. Government spending has also climbed sharply from 18.5% in 2001 to nearly 20% for each of the past 3 years. Government tax revenues plunged. They were 19.8%, almost 20%. In other words, we were bringing in 19.8% of GDP for revenue in taxes, and we were spending 18.5% in 2001. In other words, we had a surplus. Now, we're spending almost 20% of total GDP, and our tax revenue, 16.3%. 16.3%. We're now standing at $8.184 trillion in debt. $8.184 trillion, borrowing $2 billion a day. Now, consider, the total U.S. gross domestic product is only $11 trillion, and we have $8 trillion in debt. Now, if your income was $50,000 a year and you owed $40,000, what do you think the odds are that you could easily dig out of that hole? And in addition to that, we're having to borrow $171 billion just to finance the debt. I mean, we're now borrowing money to pay interest on the money that we've borrowed. And sometime in mid-March, as John Snow, our Treasury Secretary, you know, the billionaire, the multimillionaire, excuse me, who was chairman of the conference board, former chairman of Alcoa, as I recall, major, and one of the railroad companies, major wealthy guy, major Bush contributor. He's now the Secretary of Treasury. He says, we will run out of funds for financing government operations by mid-March at the latest, even if the U.S. Department of Treasury takes all possible legal measures to keep the foreign debt ceiling from going up. They're going to have to go to Congress and say, we need to borrow some more money. Now, he's talking about this happening in March. This is where it gets really interesting. You look at March. March is when Iran is talking about officially switching its sale of oil from dollars to euros. And about setting up a trading floor for oil in euros. China is talking about, in March, making sure that the basket of currencies against which they value the yuan, their currency, has fewer dollars in it. Currently, 70% of that is U.S. dollars. And in March is when the U.S. Federal Reserve is going to stop publishing the M3 number. The M3 number is the number at which we're printing money out of thin air. By the way, another country that doesn't publish their M3 number, Russia. So here we have the Fed pulling the plug on this information in March, at the same time that we're hitting our debt ceiling in March, at the same time that the Chinese are saying, not so many dollars starting in March, at the same time that Alan Greenspan is leaving and Ben Bernanke is coming in, and over the last three times, going all the way back to the Great Depression, when the Fed chairman has left and a new Fed chairman has come in, that in and of itself has been enough somehow, you know, some psychology of this or whatever, to cause at least a recession, shall we say. But we're talking here now, an $8 trillion debt. Keep in mind, when Ronald Reagan came into office, the United States had never even seen a $1 trillion debt. Ronald Reagan ran up more debt in his year in office, his 8 years in office, than every other president from George Washington to Jimmy Carter combined. You take the cost of the Revolutionary War, the cost of the Civil War, the cost of the War of 1812, the cost of World War I, the cost of World War II, the cost of the Korean War, and the cost of the Vietnamese War, all of which were financed by debt. You take all of those together and all the other borrowing that the government has done ever since the revolution in the United States, add it all up, and Reagan borrowed more money than that, creating a terrible recession. Remember the Reagan recession, the third, fourth years of his administration? And then he started spending like a drunken sailor. People say, well, the economy's coming back. Yeah, sure the economy's coming back, because George W. Bush is borrowing $2 billion a day, and because this country is, in order to finance our purchases from overseas, are borrowing as much as $6 billion a day. Excuse me, $3 billion a day, $600 billion a year. $300 days in a year, about another $2 billion. So altogether, we're borrowing a little short of $4 billion a day between paying for government operations and financing our spending spree for foreign junk in order to keep the economy alive. Yes, the economy is growing. Why? Because George W. Bush is feeding the defense industry like there's no tomorrow. Is that good for America? No. If you take money and build bombs with it, when those bombs blow up, that money is gone. You take money and you buy bullets with it, when those bullets are shot, that money is gone. You take money and you build a bridge, and you have commerce going over that bridge, or a highway, you have commerce going on that for the next 30 years, for the lifespan of that bridge, and good things happen. I mean, this is not rocket science. This is just economic fundamentals. And what we have seen is that, you know, Richard Nixon, LBJ tried this too. LBJ with his guns and butter. His Great Society programs, and at the same time he was going to have the Vietnam War. And you can't do it. And, you know, and it created an economic disaster. LBJ did it. Richard Nixon did it. Ronald Reagan did it. And George W. Bush is doing it now. You have enormous amounts of defense spending, which over the short term, yes, does stimulate the economy, because you've got all these tank manufacturers are running full tilt boogie, the defense contractors running full tilt boogie, General Electric making out like, you know, who owns NBC, just making out like bandits and all this kind of thing, making good money on the defense business, but it is not money that is being invested in anything, whereas if you use that same money to build schools, to build roads, to build buildings, to build infrastructure, to upgrade sewers, to upgrade water supplies into cities, then you see over the long term that you've made an investment in the economy, and the economy gets stronger. What we are seeing now is the economy getting weaker and weaker and weaker as a result of Reaganomics, Bushonomics, and frankly, the Clinton trade policies. And it's not doing the United States any benefit. Last time I shared this with you, people freaked out. An email. Share it with you again. What's going on in France? 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you're too arrogant. If you don't change your way, I will rise up and break the backbone of your power, and I'll place it in the hands of a nation that doesn't even know my name. I call on Washington today. I call on every man and woman of goodwill all over America today. I call on the young men of America who must make a choice today. Take a stand on this issue. Tomorrow may be too late. The book may close. And I don't know about you. I ain't gonna study war no more.
And there you go. And let us hope the day will come when that is the universal sentiment. Welcome back to our program, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartmann radio program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States. Ellen Ratner with us from Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, what's up?
I'm on a train, so I hope people behave itself. The president, of course, is...
Ellen, it's not behaving itself. I'm sorry. You just, you're breaking up. In fact, you're gone. Perhaps Ellen Ratner will get, maybe her train will get a little closer and we can do something. But anyhow, let's go to the telephones. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. I didn't get a chance. Thank you for playing that FDR quote. By the way, that was the first time after all these years, I first heard in 1973 coming back from Cleveland by Walter Mondale, that I happened to hear it. Actually hear it.
Hear what?
I wanted to thank you for that.
Oh, you're talking about last week?
Yeah, I'm sorry. The FDR quote where government can err, presence,
yes,
so on and so forth.
Yeah, better the errors of a government...
frozen in the ice of its... better the errors of the government living in the spirit of charity than the consistent omissions frozen in the Bush ice of its own difference.
You're going to get me to play it again here, Tom, or Gary, if you could just keep doing that.
I just wanted to thank you, that's all.
Yeah, okay. So what's up? Is that why you called? That was it?
You know, though, but I just happened to think of that. I want to do first things first. I'm a little fired up, and it's so glad to hear your voice. A man that's telling, we need some hard evidence here, and I think you're providing, and we thank you.
Well, thank you. Pleased to do it.
I know you are. I know it's in your heart, and it speaks volumes. But getting
back to topics,
call for. Talk about Reaganomics. Here's the facts. The facts of Reaganomics, if you will. May I throw this out there? It is a fact that during Reaganomics, and followed up by Bush, and I'm going to leave Clinton out of there on this one, and the other Bush, here's their philosophy, and here's the fact. During the Reagan years, that 1% got 70% of the income gains.
Sure.
Period.
Yeah, and it's not a secret, by the way.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's just not a secret. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it is a secret among.
It is.
Among most Americans, but
it is.
You think so? Yeah.
Because they're wealthier now. God bless them. They're wealthier on balance. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
See, but, they just right, and that the roast. It's going to come home here sooner or later. I agree with you. How it plays out, we only hope and pray that it plays out what's right here. And secondly, George Bush, the president, he's not here to defend himself, but I would say it to him in person. Mr. President, I have a quote from you. Here's what you said in 1999. I have a vision of the common good beyond profit or loss.
Yeah. Yeah, it's he's George W. Bush was really good at quoting Roosevelt, and Gary, thanks for the call. It's good to hear from you. Or he's trying to sound like Roosevelt, but he's certainly no Roosevelt, It's
better the occasional fault of a government that lives in a spirit of charity than the consistent omissions of a government frozen in the ice of its own indifference.
There you go, Franklin Roosevelt. Here's one more clip just for you junkies out there here.
He has met Europe's leaders.
Oh, this
has
is
got
Eisenhower.
Them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower.
There you go. I thought that was another FDR clip, but just as good. Back in the days when Republicans ran on the campaign platform of vote for peace, vote for Eisenhower. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Rick.
Yeah, good show, Tom, although some of what you're saying is quite bleak, but true and needs to be said. I was just wondering, you probably don't want me to mention other talk show host names, do you?
Depends on the context, I suppose.
Well, let me give an example. A conservative friend of mine sent me a CD which had a program of a conservative guy who considers himself quite a...
And we have about a half a minute left, Rick.
Okay. He had Scott Ritter on.
Mm-hmm.
Scott Ritter was talking about how he was no fan of the Bush administration, of the Clinton administration.
Right.
But yet what Clinton lied about was a lot less serious than what Bush lied about.
Right. Scott Ritter said the same thing on this program. The guy's a Republican.
And his host said, well, why isn't why hasn't George Bush been impeached, or why isn't he in prison? I guess there's got to be some conservative anger out there. Can we harness this with the left-wing anger and the people in the middle?
I think so, Rick. And I think that a lot of it's going to come out of the ballot box in this fall. And guess what? George Stephanopoulos this week. Here's the clip.
You know, if the president did break the law or circumvent the law, what's the remedy?
Arlen Specter.
Impeachment is a remedy. After impeachment, you could have a criminal prosecution.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
It's becoming more precarious. The failing to toe the line in what I believe in sounds like freedom to me.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change. Yeah, like, you know, and all those double entendres. Anyhow, back here with you. Louise Hartman, David Poole producing the program, Alex Goldmark and Dan Jacobs there in New York City making sure that the spaceship flies straight and level. Thank you to you all. I shared this with you a few weeks ago when I first got this email from a listener in Texas who had put it together, and I got slammed with email requests and people going to our message board. And our message board, I'm sure, will come back up. Our website is hosted by Earthlink and has been for, geez, who knows how long, you know, a decade or more. And when I called their technical support today and said our website seems to have crashed, the tech support person in the Philippines told me that the server's having problems. And, you know, it's not you. Apparently a lot of people are down, so, you know, presumably they'll be back up. So my apologies to the folks who would normally be in our chat room hanging out with each other that it's not available right now. I'm sure it'll be back up tomorrow. They're usually pretty good about that. Anyhow, when I first shared this with a listener in Texas, from the chat room to our message board to email, I was getting inquiries from people. How can I get a copy of that? Well, I don't have a copy of it. I just, you know, it was put together. Literally, this guy, and in fact, I followed up on it with this guy. This guy in Texas has a relative, a cousin or a nephew or a brother or something who lives in Brittany, France. And they simply compare. The guy in Brittany, France made a few phone calls to the local McDonald's, and they compared, you know, what's it like working at McDonald's in Brittany, France versus in Texas, USA? What's it like? And the minimum wage in the United States, in Texas, USA, is $5.15. Now, truth be told, most McDonald's pay more than that, but that's the minimum wage. In Brittany, France, the minimum wage in U.S. dollars, current U.S. dollars, $9.16 an hour. We're looking at a family of four with both parents working at McDonald's 40 hours a week. Okay? And in France, it would have to be a family of four, both parents working at McDonald's 35 hours a week, because that's the maximum work week. In the U.S., that couple would have time off of 6 weeks without pay for having a child. In France, for having a child, that couple would get 1 year with pay of $1,000 a month or 3 years of $700 a month while they're off. The income for the American family, assuming that they're being paid minimum wage, and as I said, McDonald's very often pays more than minimum wage, but this is the legal minimum wage in the United States. In the United States, it would be $412 a week or $1,771 a month. In Brittany, France, it would be $641 a week, $2,757 a month, plus they would get a $350 a month bonus, or as it were, payment from their employer for having two children, to help cover the cost of child care. Your pay actually goes up if you have children. The rent on a two-bedroom apartment in San Antonio, Texas, where this guy happens to live, this is just average two-bedroom apartment, $600. Well, for a low-income person, which you would be in Brittany, France, if you were working at $9.16, the minimum wage at McDonald's, you would get government housing subsidy, so your two-bedroom apartment near the Vent, which is, I'm presuming, a river that runs through Brittany, France, $200 a month. Child care, The couple who work at McDonald's in the United States probably can't afford any. In Brittany, France, it's free and it's paid for by the government. Health insurance. The couple in America, probably none because it's too expensive. The couple in France, free universal health care. Everything is covered. Checkups, dental, eye care, everything. Vacation? There is no mandated vacation in the United States. In Brittany, France, you work for McDonald's. You get the same as any other minimum wage worker in France gets. The employer is required to pay, to give you full pay, 5 weeks a year after your first week of employment. School. In the United States, you can send your kids to school for free from kindergarten to high school. So when they graduate, they are qualified to go back to work for McDonald's, just like you did. But the family of four, two, mom and dad and two kids, or, you know, mom and mom or dad and dad for that matter. Anyhow, family of four in Brittany, France with two kids, they get free education for their children from preschool all the way up to getting a PhD at the university. So their children are qualified to go to work for pretty much anybody, not just McDonald's, or to start their own business or to, you know, do a Bill Gates thing, whatever. Now, let's say that this family gets unemployed. In the United States, in San Antonio, Texas, that family would get $911 a month for 26 weeks, and then it goes to zero. And, you know, about a year after that, you're not even considered unemployed anymore. You're considered a discouraged worker, so you don't even show up in our statistics. In France, if you're unemployed from your $9.16 an hour job at McDonald's, you get $2,000 a month until you get a new job, regardless of how long it takes. Retirement, in the United States, Social Security, age 67. In France, Social Security, age 60. So there's the difference. And again, as I started the first hour of the program, the cons would have you think that laissez-faire capitalism, that absolutely unrestrained, let the businesses do anything they want, let the CEOs take as much pay as they want, keep the taxes on wealth very, very low, hit the middle class with the taxes. We shouldn't have free universities, things like that. All the cons would have you think that a completely, quote, free, end quote, economic system is the same thing as democracy. The French would beg to differ, as would the Swedes and the Norwegians and the Finns and the Danish and the Germans and the Italians and on it goes. And they'd say, no, I'm sorry. Democracy is we the people, we get together and we decide this is how it's going to be. You want to do business in our country? There's some certain minimum standards. Some minimum, just basic minimum stuff you've got to do. Ken is on the line. Hey, Ken, welcome to the program. I don't have a city for you, Ken, showing up on the screen here.
Seattle.
You're out of Seattle. Ken in Seattle. So what's up, Ken?
Well, two things. First off, you're talking about the minimum wage and all that. When I was over in England a couple of years ago, I'm a Burger King fan, and I went into Burger King. It was it's $3.69 for a meal over here. It's $3.69 over there, but they're talking pounds instead of dollars, so it's like twice as expensive.
Right. You know, which brings us back to the point that the conservatives make, which is where they say, if we were to follow if we were to go back to the trade policies that we had in the 1960s, 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, before Ronald Reagan and before George W. Bush with fast track authority, if we were to go back to those trade policies where you had taxes, import taxes on things, so that our jobs stayed here in the United States, everything in Walmart, for example, was made in the U.S., everything might be 20% more expensive. Wouldn't that be a terrible thing? And I say, well, you know, it'd be 20% more expensive, but you'd be making a salary instead of making, $9,000, $10,000, $14,000 a year. You'd be making $30,000, $40,000 a year. So, I'm willing to pay 20% more at Walmart if it means my paycheck is twice as big.
Oh, absolutely. And if they're on unemployment for $2,000 a month, there's 173 hours in a month, so they make more money on unemployment than they do working at 9-3.
Yeah. What that points out is the reality is that most people choose to work, even in social situations where that may be the case. And there's a social stigma associated with unemployment, and there's you know, the and this is you know where the Reaganites get it so wrong about, you know, the welfare mothers and their Cadillacs and all that, you know, and in fact they were never able to find a woman who drove a Cadillac and lived on food stamps. But the reality is that the majority of people would prefer to work.
Oh, absolutely. What I called you about the initial thing was, you know, you talk about an $8 trillion debt. It's really way more than that. We owe a whole ton of money to Social Security and the health care. I heard it was either 17 or 20 or $43 trillion.
Yeah, I've heard numbers.
Outlandish amount.
Yeah, and it depends on the event horizon that you're defining. You know, whether when you're talking about the internal debts, like Social Security and Medicare, you could, you know, project it forward 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. I've heard numbers as high as $50, $60, $70 trillion. But, see, that also doesn't take into account, you know, the annual revenues that are associated with that. I think the $8 trillion that we actually owe, where people are actually holding IOUs, they're holding treasury bills, compared with the $11 trillion, which is our gross domestic product, that in and of itself is a sufficiently scary number. We never had a debt over $1 trillion before Ronald Reagan came into office.
Oh, exactly.
This is absolutely unprecedented.
Us bankrupting the Russians.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the question is, does that $8 trillion include all the money that the government owes to Social Security?
No.
Remember back in 87 when, or 83 or whenever it was that Reagan doubled the Social Security withholding because we in that generation were going to have to pay for our folks, and we were saving ahead.
And we were also paying for ourselves, right.
And now they're saying, well, the future generations are paying for us. You know, I stocked a bunch of money in that's supposed to be mine, and he's flushed that down the dingwa.
That's right. Well, or it's been borrowed. I mean, what happened, Ken, was Greenspan came, and thanks for the call. Greenspan came along and said to Reagan, you know, okay, we're going to do this Reaganomics thing. Reagan cuts taxes like crazy, and all of a sudden there's no money. So Greenspan says, well, you know, instead of showing up as a huge national debt, if you borrow from Social Security, it's government borrowing from government, so it won't show as debt. And ever since Reagan, about $250 billion a year has been borrowed from Social Security to, quote, reduce the national debt. But we owe it to ourselves, but we still owe it. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
There you go, Tracy. Welcome back. It's 9 minutes before the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program, the real free speech zone. No barbed wire, no required RNC passes. We won't drag you off to jail or drag you away anyway if you've got a no blood for oil bumper sticker on your car, like they will in Florida. 1-866-440-8466, our phone number. Brian in Manchester, New Hampshire. Hey, Brian, I heard you on the air with Charles Goyette. I heard a little bit of his program on Friday where he was filling in for me while I was in New York, and good call, good conversation you guys had. What's up?
Hi, thank you, sir. I wanted to say quickly about, you're right, about every president since President Reagan, they've been stealing from the Social Security annual surplus for their national budgets every year. That includes Reagan, Bush Sr., and Bill Clinton, and George Bush II.
Yeah. The only politician, by the way, to have spoken out against this was Al Gore. And
right,
he kept talking about it in the debates, and nobody understood what he was talking about.
His lockbox proposal, yes, we need a law for that, absolutely. As if this president is going to pay attention to any law, but that's what we need under a civilized America. But I wanted to talk about Iran. And I could say that I can live with a nuclear Iran. I mean, with an Iran with nuclear weapons. And the point may be partly moot because Israel would wipe out those weapons before they really.
Yeah, well, the fact of the matter is, I mean, Pakistan has nuclear weapons right now, and India has nuclear weapons. I am really torn. I have to say, Brian, I am really torn between, on the one hand, my concern about nuclear proliferation, and on the other hand, my concern that there are a whole lot of things out there that are much bigger threats. For example, all the loose nukes in the Soviet Union, the former Soviet states, and B, that the way that we're handling this is totally wrong. As Charles was talking about last Friday, we just really need to have a practical approach that stops antagonizing the world and that does something to bring peace to the world rather than simply saying that we can walk around and say we've got the biggest stick in town and we're going to whack you upside the head if you get out of line. line, and therefore you should, because I'm sorry, over the short term that may work. Over the long term, it creates more problems than it solves, as we've seen over and over and over again. Brian, thanks a lot for the call. By the way, Graham just sent me a note. He says, in 2005, for the first time on record, consumer, business, and government spending exceeded the total income of the country. It's the first national dis-savings since 1934, the depths of the Great Depression. Amazing. Amazing. For those of you who like the fancy language, that is Q3 combined spending by corporations, federal, state, and local governments and households exceeded combined income by -1.3%. Corporate net savings were more than offset by government deficits, and households spent -1.8% more than their disposable income. Business investment continued to rebound in Q3, and DOD spending jumped. But real after-tax personal income fell again and is now lower than 2004 Q4. For those of you who that just sounds like economic gibberish to, the bottom line is that if George W. Bush wasn't borrowing $2 billion a day from the Chinese dictators, from the communist dictators of China, and injecting it into the American economy to make it look like we have a decent economy, we would have an economy right now that would resemble that of the Great Depression. And someday the Chinese are going, the depths of the Great Depression, and at some point the Chinese are going to say, sorry, we're not going to loan you any more money. Or, if you want us to continue borrowing money from us, you got to pay a whole lot higher interest rate. And then we're going to be faced with a choice. Do we dramatically scale back our lifestyles and pay off this debt? I mean, dramatically scale back our lifestyles and pay off this debt? Or do we inflate our currency like crazy so that it costs $500 a gallon for gas, you know, $175 for a loaf of bread, so our money has less value so we can pay off an $8 trillion debt in 1 year with money that has less value, which is, by the way, the route that Germany took after World War I to make war reparations from the Treaty of Versailles. They had to pay back the rest of Europe for all the damage they did in World War I. They simply inflated their currency. What did it do? It set the stage for the rise of Hitler. Those are the choices we face as a result of the economic policies of Ronald Reagan, George Bush Sr., Bill Clinton, and George Bush Jr. Now, let me just acknowledge Bill Clinton's domestic economic policies were rational and sound. His international trade policies, though, were just as crazy as the rest of them. Joe in Brookings, Oregon. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program.
Yeah, well, I think today is just as good a day as any to talk about those homeless people being beat up and even killed down there in Florida.
You're talking about the ones that got caught on videotape?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, these little teenage scumbags going around, you know, beating them up with baseball bats and this sort of thing. And it is quite outrageous that two of these little punks are just being charged as juveniles for the time being.
Yeah.
So I guess the question is, are homeless people, do they count as three-fifths of a person?
Well,
or
there you go.
Homeless people not count at all?
Or do they not count it as all? Joe, you brought up an essential point, and that is that ever since Reagan started trashing people who don't have means, if you didn't have inherited wealth, or if you weren't a corporate CEO, you know, the welfare queens that Reagan talked about, ever since Reagan started trashing people who were the working poor and the truly poor in this country, we have degraded the value of that human life, and that's just a terrible thing. Steve in Springfield, Mass. Hey, Steve. Whoop, got to push the right button here. Hey, Steve, what's up?
I don't know. I'm kind of off my original point. I was thinking more about your. This is the second time I've heard you do the comparison between Brittany and San Antonio.
Yeah.
Conditions and something I never hear said. I was. I'm kind of a nouveau pauvre, so I can't go there anymore, but when I was young, I had generous parents and stuff and was able to go to France. And with France,
Steve, can you wrap it up in about 5 or 10 seconds here quickly?
Okay. I saw plenty of millionaires and yachts in the south of France.
Sure.
And plenty of lavish living in Paris, too,
yep.
And many other parts of France. And I suspect it's still there.
So you're suggesting that the wealthy are the ones who don't want to work?
Well, no. That was my original point. But no, what I'm suggesting is that a welfare state doesn't necessarily drive out the wealthy.
Oh, yeah. Well said, Steve. You're absolutely right. And I mean, look at Sweden for that. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the Real Free Speech Zone, the Tom Hartman radio program. Back in 1970, Christopher Pyle, disclosed the U.S. military's surveillance of civilian politics and worked as a consultant to three congressional committees, including the Church Committee. He's currently a professor at Mount Holyoke College, co-author of the book The President, Congress, and the Constitution, and author of the book Military Surveillance of Civilian Politics. Christopher Pyle, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir.
It must seem to you like deja vu all over again.
Yes, it does. It's not surprising. Whenever there are crises, the government gets curious and begins to collect information. But it's the scale of the information and the irrelevance that is so striking to me. I have reviewed 400 pages of incident reports collected by the military in the past year, and the general worthlessness of it all is what strikes me most.
And yet, at the same time, in order to get this generally worthless stuff, we are giving up our liberties in a very real way, are we not?
Well, we certainly could be, because what we see here is, again, the apparatus of a police state. I'm not suggesting that the people who are running the system think like police state types, but they have the capability, because they are collecting so much information by computer, by telecommunications, by linking intelligence agencies together. And that's unfortunate. It's a waste of taxpayers' time and money. It is a waste of our resources that could be better spent dealing with Al-Qaeda overseas, perhaps.
And yet, Christopher Pyle, most police states are run by people who not only claim to have, you know, a benign benevolence, the interests of the people at heart and in mind, but I think, frankly, they believe it. I think that they think that the best way to have a safe and secure society is to have a locked-down society. I mean, you know, the Bush administration certainly seems to be making those kind of noises, particularly Dick Cheney. I mean, these claims of inherent executive power, that they can wiretap people, that they can torture people, that they can establish a whole separate category of human beings separate from prisoners of war under the Geneva Convention or criminals under the U.S. Constitution, and those people have no rights under either. I mean, doesn't this... I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'll say, for me, this sounds like police state stuff.
Yes, that certainly does. When you begin to look at those operations, as long as you have a government under law and you have checks and balances and you have an active press and you don't have too much secrecy, and you certainly don't have secrecy about things that don't need to be kept secret, you can maintain a free society. When you begin to get the extent of secrecy we have now, combined with the reports we have of torture, of brutality, of cruelty, and then the claims in defense that the president is essentially above the law, this is extremely disturbing.
The unitary executive branch?
Excuse me?
The unitary executive branch?
Yeah, unitary executive powers is a remarkable theory. What it says is that, well, it can say many different things and has been used to say many different things, but the extreme version of it is that if the law forbids the president to conduct electronic surveillance, as NSA has been doing, as the president ordered them to do, the president can ignore that law, even though the law says that to ignore this law is a crime.
Right.
And that's what happened with the president's order to NSA. The president committed a crime.
Now, wasn't it Sam Alito who initially came up with this concept when he was working for the Reagan White House in the 1980s?
Well, Sam Alito urge that the administration make more use of presidential signing statements, so that if Congress wrote a law that the president didn't like, the president could issue a signing statement giving that law a narrow interpretation in the hopes that future courts would then adopt his narrow interpretation rather than evidence of what Congress intended. Whether Sam Alito intended it to be used in the extreme way it's now being used is an open question.
Well, what other possible reason could there be?
Well, there's a continual tug of war between Congress and the president. Congress is always trying to get more information, so it creates commissions and bodies that are supposed to reveal information to members of Congress and to committees of Congress. And Congress is trying to insulate executive officials and all sorts of agencies from being fired without cause by the president. They try to undermine the president's control over the executive branch, and for often very good reasons. The president, on the other side, wants to unify his control over the executive branch so that everybody there works for him. If the believers in unitary executive power had their way, the president would control many of the independent regulatory agencies of government. He would have power to essentially line item veto acts of Congress, just ignoring provisions he didn't like.
Right, so EPA, FDA, OSHA, all of these organizations would simply have to dance to his tune. And if he didn't like the way that Congress defined their specific responsibilities, he could feel free to ignore them.
Exactly, yes.
And this certainly doesn't in any way reflect anything that I've ever read in the Constitution.
Well, the Constitution permits a tug-of-war. It's designed for a tug-of-war. The president is trying to pull it so heavily in one direction, and Congress, being run by his own party, is not resisting.
Right.
And as a result, we're seeing concentrations of executive power that are disturbing. A certain amount of this is understandable. Every administration, Democratic and Republican, does it. But when you start saying that the president has the power to ignore the criminal laws that forbid torture, forbid cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment of prisoners, that forbid detention, indefinite detention, denying access to counsel, access to families, creating ghost detainees, this is fairly extreme. This is the stuff of a police state that's not an innocent police state. It's not just excessive information gathering, as the case with the Army spying. It's power development, and that is disturbing and needs to be restrained.
So here's the $64,000 question. We're talking with Christopher Pyle, Professor Christopher Pyle at Mount Holyoke College. When you were a consultant to the Church Committee, which was looking into somewhat similar abuses by the Nixon administration,
oh, yes,
and other previous administrations, at least we had an adversarial Congress. I mean, you had parts of Congress in the hands of the Democrats. Now there is no adversarial branch of government. I mean, or at least the adversarial nature of it has vanished because we have largely Republicans in control of the judiciary, certainly conservatives in charge of the Supreme Court, conservative Republicans in charge of the House and the Senate, and the White House. Concerns among the populace about the freedom of our elections. In the minute or so we have left, what do we do about this?
Well, I would suggest you encourage Republicans. Republicans like Arlen Specter, Sam Brownback, and others, who have begun to question this concentration of executive power. Not all Republicans are enablers. There are many Republicans who realize the significance of this power concentration.
And yet Arlen Specter has come out and said he's going to vote in favor of Sam Alito, and Sam Alito is one of the advocates of this.
Well, I'm not sure Alito is. I would not put him in the front rank of advocates. Arlen Specter is also planning to hold hearings on the National Security Agency's surveillance activities.
Are you sure these are real and not cosmetic?
Well, I am not an insider to what his intentions are.
I mean, is it your sense?
But I have a sense that they're serious hearings. And this is not unusual. When one party gets into power, the party begins to break up into factions itself.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a general skepticism to the concentration of power that runs through Republicans and Democrats in this country.
Right.
And so I think it is possible that you're going to see some Republican leadership here in restraining this president. And should that happen, we all need to give it considerable support.
Yeah, and encourage the Republicans to take back their party or start behaving like, you know, in traditional American ways. The Patriot Act has this category of disruptor in it. People can now be jailed for disruptive behavior. We have just a few seconds left. Does this concern you?
Well, I'm not sure what provision you're referring to, but yes, if people can be jailed for disruptive behavior, that concerns me a great deal.
Yeah, well, worth checking out. Christopher H. Pyle, author of The President, Congress, and the Constitution and Military Surveillance of Civilian Politics, professor at Mount Holyoke College. Thank you so much for being with us today, sir.
Thanks.
Good speaking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I call on Washington today. I call on every man and woman of goodwill all over America today. I call on the young men of America who must make a choice today. Take a stand on this issue. Tomorrow may be too late. The book may close. And I don't know about you, I ain't gonna study war no more.
Amen. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to the program. The place where being progressive never felt so good. Dr. Gil Smolin has been a clinical professor and researcher at the University of California for more than 3 decades. He wrote a book called Reign of the Rat, which is a fact-based thriller about a resistant germ arising in Asia that causes a deadly worldwide pandemic. Dr. Smolin, are we seeing your novel come to life?
Unfortunately, yes. I should say I'm very humbled by following Martin Luther King on your program.
Yeah, today is Martin Luther King Day, and we're using a lot of his clips as bumper music, and for me personally, it's a wonderful opportunity to hear the great words of a great man again.
Yes, I agree. What I want to say was, now that the bird flu seems to be spreading outside of Asia, the thought of it becoming a pandemic is more real. And I think it's important.
Why is that?
Well, it's still being transmitted from birds to humans. But the more humans that have the disease, the more birds that have the disease, the more likely it is for the virus to combine into a form that will eventually or may go from human to human.
Basically, all it has to do is infect a human who is carrying infectious flu, and these two share genes with each other, and boom, we've got a brand new organism.
Right. It's called reassortment. But basically, right. If people will think about two viruses sort of mating, and you have a human, as you say, with a human virus, and the flu season is increasing, and February, March are usually the height of the flu season. And now the bird flu is spreading also. So the chance of someone getting, it doesn't have to even be a human. It could be, as in 1918, even a pig or another animal that will get the human flu and the bird flu at the same time. And if that happens, the two viruses can reassort or assemble their genetic material and produce a new virus, a new strain, that can go from human to human. That would be extraordinarily dangerous.
We're speaking with Dr. Gil Smolin, a clinical professor and researcher at the University of California. Does that mean that we should all be stockpiling Tamiflu, or does that mean that we're doomed, or that we should buy stock in the companies that make alcohol wipes and all start behaving like Mr. Monk in the TV show, or what?
There's some very good options, but there are also alternatives. One of the problems that I wanted to address with you, Tom, is that I think people don't realize that the vaccine and the Tamiflu are not going to be enough to stop someone from getting the disease or stop this pandemic.
Right.
And the reason is, whenever this transformation occurs from the bird flu to transforming it to a new form that goes from human to human, at that time, they will have to try to produce a vaccine for this new form, and that'll take almost 9 months to a year.
And by that time, the virus will have mutated again.
Yes. So therefore, people have to understand that the virus, the vaccine, the bird flu vaccine, at best, will be very moderately effective.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, they're not going to be able to produce enough, and secondly, it's only going to be moderately effective.
And what about the antiviral drugs that are out there?
That's, at the moment, there's all sorts of questions of what doses to use, whether people are already resistant to the Tamiflu. This particular virus is already, in some cases, appears to be resistant to the Tamiflu. So I don't think people can count on the Tamiflu and the vaccine.
Right.
What
now
they're going to have to count on is two things, basic principles. One is maintaining a resistance, high resistance, and trying to avoid contact with the viral agent. And maintaining resistance is always good. And things like sleeping, long.
Keep yourself healthy.
Excuse me?
Keep yourself healthy, in other words.
Yes. And as far as preventing oneself from getting the virus, the ways that people can do that is wash your hands, wear a mask if necessary, avoid crowds, avoid areas where you know people may have the flu.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be very crucial for each individual to be intelligent about trying to prevent themselves from getting the virus, and secondly, maintaining good resistance.
And
you know,
it seems
very interesting. In 1918, when the Spanish flu struck and killed about 50 million people, that most of the people who died were in the 20 and 30 year age group.
Mm-hmm.
And that's counter to what most people think. They think it will be very young children and the elderly because of the resistance.
Yeah.
But the fact remains that the people who were in their 20s and 30s were fighting a war. And these were people in the trenches. So they were in close quarters, under tremendous lowered resistance, tremendous stress. And they were the ones who mainly died from the flu.
Yeah, fascinating. Dr. Gil Smolin, thanks so much for being with us. Clinical professor and researcher at the University of California's book, Reign of the Rat. And thank you so kindly for sharing your wisdom with us. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And time, it's, you know, Monday, the last hour of the day, and time for us to do our regular look at the best of the rest of the news. It's, you know, what has been happening in the over the last few days, what's happening now, what's going to be happening, what's going to be coming up over the next few days from the viewpoint of folks who are involved in the alternative press and really out there on the front lines. We have Doug Cunningham with us with LaborRadio.com, who those of you particularly who listen to our web stream on AirAmericaRadio.com or on RadioPower.org or WhiteRoseSociety.org or cable radio network, CRN digital.com, workers independent news, laborradio.org, and Gonzo Schechschneider.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Hey, Gonzo, BuzzFlash.com, and BuzzFlash.com, certainly the premier, or one of the premier, I'm not sure exactly how you describe yourself, BuzzFlash.com, news sites.
Well, we're just pro-democracy and anti-hypocrisy. That's pretty.
There you go. Pro-democracy and anti-hypocrisy. Well said, Gonzo. So, Doug, first of all, labor, from the labor point of view and or any other point of view you want to share with us, what do you see as the biggest story happening right now?
Well, I think the airlines probably is the biggest story right now in the next couple of days. But before we go into that, I just want to briefly say, this being Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, when we honor his memory and his work, I think it's useful for people to remember that he was assassinated. He was killed in Memphis as he was there on behalf of sanitation workers in Memphis, AFSCME Local 1733 and their strike, and they went on to successfully win that strike. And so Dr. King is honored for a variety of reasons today, but we and at liberradio.org would like to remember him for his work with workers and on behalf of workers, especially those who were struggling, low-paid workers.
Which was a very, very big part of what he did, and in fact, one of the main things that that earned him the enmity of J. Edgar Hoover, who thought that he was a communist because he was, you know, he was socially progressive with regard to issues like labor and minimum wage and those kinds of things.
Very much so, and he was so intensely concerned about that issue that even after his death, his widow, Coretta Scott King, came to Memphis to lead the march that he had planned before he was killed. And so she did that on the day before Dr. King's funeral in Atlanta. So labor issues were very high in his mind and very important for him. And I hope that all those who honor him today will keep that in mind and, if they can, get involved in the labor movement.
So you said the big story that's not being covered by the mainstream media right now is the airlines?
Well, I mean, it's being covered by the mainstream media, of course, because it's important to business. But it's you know, being covered quite often from the perspective of Northwest Airlines and from the business perspective rather than from the workers' perspective.
Right.
And tomorrow there's going to be a federal bankruptcy hearing where Northwest was scheduled to ask that its union contracts be tossed out. Now, the International Association of Machinists on Sunday announced that they do have what they think is an agreement with Northwest that backs Northwest off of some of its more stringent demands, and no details on that yet, but that's going to be presented to their membership on Tuesday. So at least for the IAM, that could postpone this court decision. But if this bankruptcy judge decides to throw out these union contracts, that's going to trigger a strike at Northwest, and that's going to possibly destroy the company. A pilot strike in 1998 cost Northwest hundreds of millions of dollars. Very briefly, too, Tom, one thing that maybe not has been covered so much by the mainstream media, we're hearing from a source in Detroit, a civil rights attorney there, that the FBI paid a visit in regards to a UAW rank-and-file protest march that happened in Detroit at the auto show on January 8th. Detroit civil rights attorney Julie Hurwitz says the FBI paid her office a visit and also another attorney's home regarding the protest. She said they wouldn't tell her what exactly they wanted to know, but they were looking for another attorney, and that other attorney, who she did not name publicly, she said that attorney confirmed that these folks identified themselves as being from the FBI.
So, Doug, with LaborRadio.org, are you suggesting that we are back to the days where the FBI is being used as a vehicle of intimidation against people in the labor movement?
Well, you know, I don't know to the extent that that's happening, but I would guess, and not just a guess, but I mean based on some other reports from the ACLU and others, the Patriot Act is being used more and more for domestic surveillance, and for domestic surveillance that includes the FBI paying these visits to these folks, which Julie Hurwitz, the civil rights attorney in Detroit, says is a chilling thing that violates, in her opinion, the Bill of Rights, and she says that when the FBI starts poking around using the Patriot Act or other laws, national security laws, on legitimate American dissent, that indeed could be intimidating to members of the labor movement, civil rights movement, anti-war movement, and others.
Amazing. Gonzo, over at BuzzFlash.com, what are you guys seeing as the main story happening right now?
Well, I do think the FBI spying leads into the whole NSA wiretapping lawlessness that's coming from the Bush administration. I mean, I think that... Right, that sort of is a signal that I think we're actually making headway in exposing a lot of the illegalities of the Bush administration's war on terror. And the fact that they're using the FBI that way, and that we hear they're using the FBI that way, the fact they're spying on grandmothers who protest in Florida, and the fact that Bush had really no legal recourse to go around the FISA court, I mean, he broke the law. That's it, he broke the law. There's no question about it, and whether or not you, at this point, it's whether or not you support the imperial presidency.
Well, he also broke the law when he lied to Congress about Iraq having weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah,
he's gotten away with this before.
He has. We just right now we don't have. It's not as clear a path to the lie as this is. I mean, in fact, that he's even come out and admitted, yeah, I broke the law. He didn't say he broke the law, but he came out and said I went around the court, and even there's no reason for him to go around the court. So. I think that is is a real big issue. In fact, Harper's index for January 15th has that 51% of Americans said in November that Valerie Plame leak scandal was of great importance. 49% 2 months before President Nixon resigned, said that Watergate was very serious. So I think that things like Plame and the NSA and these things are starting to catch up with.
But Nixon had a Democratic Congress to deal with.
Well, let's hope for a best in 2006.
Yeah, and it's going to take more than just the best, given all the dirty tricks that these guys play and have played in previous elections.
Yeah.
Gonzo, I wonder to what extent you think that the upcoming hearings, Gonzo with BuzzFlash.com, the upcoming hearings that Arlen Specter has promised, looking into this admitted crime by the president with regard to the NSA spying, to what extent they're going to be show hearings we did it so that we could say we did it kind of thing, you know, like some alleged the 9/11 commission was or the Warren Commission for that matter, if you want to go back to that, versus an actual attempt by Republicans who are real, you know, some small remnant of a Republicans who are really and truly horrified by the abuse of presidential power to get to the bottom of it and stop it.
You know, I don't hold a lot of faith that it'll happen. I mean, I think if, you know, you want to use a barometer, look at whether or not they actually enact some ethics requirements on Congress, the Republicans actually do anything about ethics.
Well, just today we learned that they're not going to.
Yeah, well, so I think that's a signal that, you know, we just...
At least in the House.
Yeah, you know, so I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, it's a lot of nice talk. I do think that it's a signal that the Republicans are slowly starting to get fed up with, you know, Bush's imperial presidency, but I don't know that it's going to result in anything useful.
Yeah. Doug Cunningham at laborradio.org, I'm wondering to what extent do you think that the Bush imperial presidency might actually end up backfiring? I mean, here you had Reagan who declared war on organized labor, and we've seen this steady drumbeat, the steady hostility toward labor in the Labor Department and others, with the brief exception of the Clinton White House. Even that was, I would say, lukewarm toward labor, but nonetheless, at least they weren't openly hostile like these guys are.
Right.
But is Bush overreaching now, or do you think that, I mean, what do you see?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that will bounce back against Bush. I think that the imperial presidency alienates not just those who are traditional Bush opponents and enemies politically, but also folks who are within the Republican Party to see this. I mean, people in other branches of the government, the Congress, obviously, for example, don't appreciate it when an imperial presidency overreaches, and they don't appreciate it even if it's a member of their own party that occupies the White House.
Do you see, though, Doug, do you see the average guy? I mean, I can't tell you how many. I speak at a lot of union events. I'm keynoting the SEIU conference here in Oregon in 2 weeks.
Oh,
and I talk to a lot of labor folks. And I can't tell you how many rank-and-file labor people that I talk to who think that George W. Bush is a great guy, that they'd love to have a beer with him. I mean, do you think that this is going to start to sink in?
Well, yeah, we do see that phenomenon happening because of the so-called likability that Bush has among some people, you know, and it's difficult to reach the rank and file on a mass level with the message. But, you know, if they clearly just take a look at what Bush's record is versus whether they'd like to have a beer with him, I mean, having a beer with a guy is one thing. You know, endorsing his policies and supporting his policies is quite another.
Having him rip off your job.
Right. Well, yeah, right. I mean, you know, if you put it that way, I mean, a lot of people are not active, unfortunately, within the labor movement. Rank and file unions have their job cut out for them there, too, to mobilize and energize their own members and their rank and file members, you know, to do
right.
something about this presidency and about these policies. But and it's an ongoing battle, and it's a struggle, and our only hope is that we can keep struggling, keep communicating, keep firing away, and get these masses of folks that are in the rank and file labor movement organized, mobilized, energized, and informed, you know, and once that happens, I think we can begin to make some headway. And unions don't always lose, even in this very hostile environment. There's still a residual amount of power that unions have, even though they've been beleaguered for many years now. And there's a determination among the core of labor union leaders and many labor activists to continue the fight and to expand the fight until we reach a point where we can start winning.
We just have a few seconds left. Gonzo Schechschneider at BuzzFlash.com. Optimistic, pessimistic over the near term here?
I'm feeling a little optimistic.
Because?
Because I think that it's catching up to him.
Yeah.
And we're seeing some people rebel that hadn't normally rebelled.
I'm getting that same sense. Gonzo with BuzzFlash.com. Doug with LaborRadio.org. Thank you, gentlemen, both for being with us today.
Thank you.
Much appreciated. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour in the Darwinian world of ideas, we're at the top of the food chain here on the Tom Hartman radio program. Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico with us. Hey, Roy, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling in.
Good afternoon, Tom. This being Martin Luther King's birthday celebration day, let me preface what I really want to talk about with. I talked to a lovely Christian woman in Byhalia, Mississippi today that was absolutely surprised that the garbage men were picking up trash day. It was Martin Luther King's birthday, and they all black.
Mm.
I was just absolutely disgusted with my mother. But anyway,
your
that
mother.
Being said,
yeah. Okay.
And she's a lovely Christian lady.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason for my call, I wanted to just challenge folks. Here in New Mexico, tomorrow, at the opening of the state legislature, the governor will put on what is called the call, a challenge for the legislature to pass a law that every county in this state will use verifiable paper ballots read by OptiScan machines. And that is the result of 6 or 8 folks absolutely knocking themselves out. Then there was 10, 15, 20, 30 of us kind of on the second tier that were kind of helping them.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was probably 30, maybe 100, 200 people max that were involved.
Now, what you have to combine with that, Roy, is some sort of provision for actually auditing those pieces of paper, because you'll recall the machines that got hacked in Leon County, Florida, successfully, were optical scan machines.
They are. There is an audible portion to already in the existing election reform.
Mm-hmm.
But the
Great.
Governor himself has actually put this on the bill.
Bill Richardson.
And where that comes in is we're in what's called a short session this time, where the legislature can only consider financial bills. Because this is a financial $11 million bill to purchase the machines, that's how it's going to be on this thing. And the half a dozen guys that are really guys and gals that have been really pushing this, that really know the stuff, Holly and Paul Stokes and all of these other folks, they are absolutely ecstatic.
That's great. Well, good luck, and Roy, give us a call tomorrow and let us know.
The whole point, though, Tom, is, damn it, this was because about a dozen people got involved. There was a few of us that helped them. And there was no more than a couple hundred people in this whole state driving this thing. So everybody, get out there and agitate and hustle.
There you go. Well said, Roy. And congratulations for your victory, your success so far. And give us a call and let us know how Governor Richardson handles all this, how it all shakes out, okay?
Gotcha. Take care.
Okay. Talk to you soon. Steve in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom. Privilege. Hey, interesting little tidbit with regard to the avian flu topic. Friday, CDC announced that two of the antivirals that were of the four that supposedly were showing an effectiveness with the two current strains of flu that are predominant here in the States right now were proving ineffectual. I heard that on and off on Friday a number of times, then it dropped off the map. Saturday, another news item with regard to the two of the four antivirals that were proving effective, one of which was, believe it or not, Tamiflu.
Right.
Since then, nothing.
Interesting.
Been real curious as to showed up and disappeared.
Yeah.
I understand, you know, with the holiday and everything.
Well, there may be some politics of money involved in all of this too, you know.
That's why I thought it was really interesting, you know.
Yeah, so thanks for the heads up, Steve. I'll keep my eyes out on that one. Tim in Peoria, Illinois. Hey, Tim.
Hi, Tom. I watched and listened on C-SPAN today to Al Gore.
Yeah, I heard he gave a great speech.
Yeah, you know, it was speak with passion for an hour in Washington about Bush and threats to our constitutional form of government. I think this was the most important and best-delivered speech I've heard in years.
Hmm.
Unfortunately, C-SPAN does not have it scheduled for rebroadcast, but at least the transcript is on Raw Story now.
Yeah, and we're going to be playing clips of it tomorrow on this program, by the way.
Fantastic.
Yeah, David has been slicing these things up all afternoon as we're doing the program here. David Poole, our producer.
It's just great. It was like a synthesis of everything I wanted to hear from Al Gore.
Yeah.
So everybody should check out that transcript and what I'll be listening to you tomorrow. And as a final comment, draft Al Gore for president.
There you go. I'd vote for him in a heartbeat. Tim, thanks a lot for the call. Al Gore, John Edwards, Howard Dean, we've got some really good, Barbara Boxer, we've got some really good people out there. Jake in Arcata, California. Hey, Jake, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Good.
I'm just calling about George Bush's most recent foreign policy debacle. You know, I must have been on vacation the day Bush declared war in Pakistan. We have dozens of dead villagers, thousands of pissed off Pakistanis in the street. This is not a good situation. Bush screwed up big time.
Yeah. Yeah, well said. I mean, this is what Clinton tried to avoid when he didn't fire on Bin Laden. And of course, everybody's been second guessing that ever since then. And I'm not going to try and second guess that. But he was trying to avoid some sort of major diplomatic incident and something that's just going to inflame the region. And apparently Bush has succeeded in inflaming the region. The question in everybody's mind now is, are these people coming into the streets because, you know, they were upset with us all along and this was, you know, enough to get them to simply speak out? Or have we caused people who really didn't care before to suddenly hate us? And that's a question for which, frankly, I don't think we know the answer, because we don't have enough good intelligence on the ground. But anyhow, we'll see how it all shakes up. Thanks for being with us today, my friends. Tomorrow, conservative Mark Morano is going to be with us. He says that Murtha, maybe he's not really a war hero. And this is a good conservative. He's going to be with us. I'm going to ask him if the new conservative standard is to slash and burn people. Tom Hayden's going to be with us. That should be great. And your calls as well. Remember, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.